there's a very interesting comment of the Prima Godim, the great halachic authority. There is a notion that one always gives a precedence and special attention to what's called inyona diyoma, matters that relate, pertain to that time. Pesach, Pesach, Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah. The Prima Godim says, Parshas Korach is inyona diyoma, every single day of the year, because it is the art of avoiding machlokas, and that's something that can apply at any given time. So, certainly when it is the time of year, davar bi'ito. And Korach remains quite elusive, and there are a number of different angles and aspects to discuss. But if we begin mamish with the practicalities, what they call in modern Hebrew praktika, and that is with regards to the timing of this whole episode. Of course, there is the simple understanding, but there is more than one way to view it, and more than one opinion that has been voiced. The Pashtus, and of course we note that this Parsha of Korach is written after Shalach, after the Parsha of the Meraglim. This ties in a little bit to our discussion of last week, but it is its own discussion. Korach features after Shalach, and therefore we'll take as our starting point the notion that Korach happened after the episode with the Meraglim. And this indeed is expressed by Rashi in this week's Parsha, because as a result of, or in response to more correctly, the claims of Korach, whatever Korach is claiming, and his men, Kol Ha'elo Kulam Kadoshim, we're all holy, why are you lording over us? Pasuk Dalet states, Vayishma Moshe Vayipol Alpanov. Moshe hears and he falls on his face, which is, in this instance, almost like a sign of despair. And the question is, why is Moshe despairing here? He's never despaired in the past. It's always been distressing when the Jewish people are causing trouble, but Moshe responds by doing something, or talking to Hashem, or whatever it will be. And indeed, he does do something, but there's this momentary vayipol apanav, it's just too much. Why is it too much? Well, Rashi says it's very simply a matter of accumulation. In other words, there's only so many things that Jewish people can do wrong before it just gets too much. Yesh gavul, as they say. And Rashi's comment is, Shekfar ze biadam, Sirchon Revi'i. This is their fourth foul, or fouling up. And what are they? Rashi lists them. Number one, Chotu Be'egel. You see, they sinned in the Egel. Moshe intercedes for them. Vayichal Moshe. Okay. Number two, Misonanim. That short section in Parshas Balosecha. Misonanim. They were punished. Vayispalel Moshe. Moshe davens for them. Meraglim. Interestingly, Rashi doesn't talk about Kivros Hatava. Meraglim is number three. Vayomer Moshe Lashem, Veshomu Mitzrayim. Moshe gets going. He intercedes on their behalf. So three for three, Moshe arbiters on their behalf. B'machloka shel Korach nisrashlu yodov. But with Korach, it's too much already. And Rashi gives a mashal, even though one could almost feel that we don't need the mashal because we get the idea. But even so, maybe we do need the Mashal. Mashal ben Melech, a prince, Shesorach al Aviv, who keeps on falling afoul of his father. And you have this well-wisher, this advisor who's there, who pies alav ohavo. And you have this person who's always interceding on behalf of the son. Pam, Shtaim, Shalosh. But everyone has their limits. Kishesorach revius nisrashlu yedeha ohev. He says, how long can this go on? Is it ad infinitum? So these are Rashi's comments, and of course we've only read the words. There's much to ponder and contemplate with regards to the full depth of what it means. But for our purposes, we do see Rashi has befeirush placed and timed the episode of Korach after the Meraglim. Meraglim's number three, Korach's number four. However, the Ibn Ezra has something to say here. And as far as the Ibn Ezra is concerned, and as we've seen in the past, Ibn Ezra, of all of the Rishonim, is the most fluid or flexible, shall we say, in terms of his understanding of the relationship between the order in which things are written in the Torah and the order in which they occurred. The Torah can work thematically, but the historical sequence can be quite different. And the Ibn Ezra understands that this machlokas with Korach and his men took place well before the Meraglim. And in explanation why he says this, you only need to consider what it is that they are complaining about. They come and they want the avoda. Well, when was it taken away from them, whoever they are? We need to find that out as well. The whole reshuffle took place in the wake of the Chet HaEgel. As we know, prior to the Chet HaEgel, the avoda was with the Bechorim. But then when they soured as a result of the Egel and Shevet Levi came through, so then things transferred from the Bechorim to the Levium. That happened yet at Har Sinai, and the Ibn Ezra is inclined to understand that that's when the episode of Korach happened. One would need to understand why the Torah wrote it here, but in terms of the sequence, it happens yet at Sinai. And now the question is, who is upset? And who are they upset at? And the answer, it appears from the Ibn Ezra, is everyone at everyone. And he breaks down those that are involved in Korach's group into different factions. And each one feels hard done by for a different reason. And the only thing that unites them is that they feel equally hard done by. The first group to feel that they've been overlooked, of course, is the Bechorim themselves, because they feel that it's not fair, the Avoda was taken from them, given to the Levium, and the Ibn Ezra himself is inclined to understand that the 250 men were actually all Bechorim, or predominantly Bechorim, and that's really what unites them. They used to have the Avoda. This time last year they were doing the Avoda, and now something's happened, and they feel disgruntled. Okay, so they're upset that it was given to the Levium. Shevet Levi, of course, should be fine, because the Avoda was given to them. Says Ibn Ezra, no. Shevet Levi are also upset, because even though the Avoda, in general, has passed into Shevet Levi, but specifically it has gone to the family of Aaron and his sons, the Levium are the helpers. They're the assistants. They would like to feel that for all of their efforts in the Egel at that time, that maybe they should be full members and fully authorized to do the Avoda. So the Bechorim are upset that the Avoda went to the Levium. The Levium are upset that the Avoda went to the Kohanim. Is there anyone left? There is. Dothan and Aviram. Now, what are Dothan and Aviram upset about? So this is an interesting question, because one might be inclined to say they don't need a reason to be upset about anything. That whatever's going, they'll take it, because their business is machlokas and causing trouble for Moshe. Having said that, they do have a platform at sorts, because we are told in the opening pasuk of the Parsha that Dothan and Aviram are from the tribe of Reuven. Okay. What's Reuven got to do with any of this? Says Ibn Ezra, Reuven was the original Bechor. Reuven Bechor Yisrael. And therefore, all of a sudden, when you're thinking that there couldn't be more claims and more arguments, there are. Dothan and Aviram come in and say, well, now that we're talking about reverting things to how they were, and it's not fair that the Avoda went from the Bechor to someone else, we're from the Bechor. I don't know that they were both Bechorim. If they're brothers, they can't both be. But they claim descendants from Reuven, and the Avoda should be with Reuven. Now, that's actually quite a claim for a number of reasons. Firstly, they're looking to revert it to pre-Egel, meaning to reverse from the Levium back to the Bechorim, and reverse even more than that, not even the Bechorim, but those who are descended from the Bechor. That's quite a claim. Now, of all of these claims, says Ibn Ezra, you might think this has the least ground to stand on, for the simple reason that it wasn't Moshe who took the Bechorah away from Reuven and gave it to anyone else. It was Yaakov. in the brachas, Yaakov says, Reuven b'chori ata, yes, but you lost it. Pachas kamayim, and therefore it goes to Yosef. So what's that got to do with Moshe? This is already the doing of Yaakov Avinu hundreds of years earlier. Says Ibn Ezra, yes, Yaakov Avinu, shall we say, ordained the transfer of the Bechora from Reuven to Yosef. But it was Moshe that implemented it, because it wasn't until Moshe's time that we see practically, or in the realms of actuality, that Yosef divides into two, and both of his sons, Menashe and Ephraim, are each functioning as independent shvatim, whether it's with regards to how they're counted, or the degel that they have, or the machanet that they have, etc. And therefore, looking to point a finger at Moshe, this is how it works. Perhaps Yaakov said it, but Moshe did it. And moreover, says Ibn Ezra, and anything is possible, they suggested that perhaps the reason why Moshe was so forthcoming in terms of delivering the Bechorah to Yosef, dividing Ephraim and Menashe into two Shvatim, well, isn't it interesting that his favored disciple, Yoshua ben Nun, is from Shevet Ephraim, and therefore perhaps that's what they call protectia, and that's why he did it. That is the assembly of Korach. Which means, says Ibn Ezra, when the Edo, which is mostly made up of Bechorim, when they come to Moshe and they say in the second pasuk, or more correctly, the third pasuk, Ki chol ha'edo kulam kadoshim, which sounds, on the one hand, very broad. The entire congregation are holy. It sounds like they're talking about the entire Jewish people. People for the people. But the truth is, as Ibn Ezra, they're not talking about everyone. When they talk about the congregation, the assembly, they're talking about Bechorim. As if to say, from within the Jewish people, there's this Ada, there's this group called Bechorim, and they're all Kedoshim. So that's interesting. It is not a national, they're not talking on behalf of the entire Jewish people. All the Jewish people are holy. But this specific Ada within them are holy. So this is the analysis number one, once again, for the Ibn Ezra of the timing, to reiterate. He sees this as having happened much earlier. And number two, what are the claims? Bechorim, Leviim, descendants of Reuven, everyone has something to say about someone else. Now, the one who pulls it back to the sequence as we have it in the Parshas, insisting that these actually happened in order, is Ramban. Ramban has a famous line here with regards to Ibn Ezra. He says, Ibn Ezra says it's written here, but it happened earlier. Says Ramban, V'lama lafoch divrei Elokim chayim. Why reverse Hashem's words? He wrote it here. Presumably it happened here. And it's an interesting example, because we have all three, shall we say, of the primary approaches to the concept that we call Ein Muktam Umu'uchar Batorah. The Gemara itself states that, in principle, Ein Muktam Umu'uchar Batorah. Sometimes the chronological order is not the what's presented in the sequence of Parshios. But now the critical question is that a principle? Is that a principle that one can apply? Is it noting an exceptional situation? And here, opinions are divided, and we see the full spectrum. Ramban will almost never say Ein Muktam Umu'uchar Batorah. He will almost never invoke it. Only if absolutely necessary, all things being equal for Ramban, the way that it's written is the order that it happened. That's the one extreme. The other extreme is Ibn Ezra, who, as we said, is quite flexible in terms of Ein Muktam Umu'uchar Batorah. The order things are written is a thematic order, but in terms of the sequence chronologically, it could be quite different. That's the other extreme. And Rashi is somewhere in the middle. He will use it, he'll invoke it more than Ramban, but less so than Ibn Ezra. So for Ramban, sparingly, for Rashi, sometimes, and for Ibn Ezra, commonly. Or as we've expressed it on other occasions, when it comes to the principle of Ein Muktam Umu'uchar Batorah, one could say that Ibn Ezra, he keeps it on the dashboard. I mean, he's ready to use it whenever. For Rashi, it's in the glove compartment, if needed. And for the Ramban, it's in the trunk, it's locked, and it's behind a pane of glass, which says, only break in case of emergency. So these are the three approaches. Now, the question that the Ramban actually addresses now is, why is it, if indeed the food for the contention is a year old almost, because it's about the replacing of the Levim with Bechorim, so why did it take so long? Why did it only happen after the Meraglim? I mean, that's a good shaila. Ibn Ezra says the basis of the issue is from Sinai, and it happened at Sinai. If Ramban insists it happened much later, why did it happen much later? Why the delayed reaction? And Ramban's answer has a great deal of irony in it, as we will see. And that is, says Ramban, an argument needs a climate. We're paraphrasing, but an argument needs a climate that allows for it, that supports it. And an argument against Moshe Rabbeinu, kal vachomer, needs a climate. You cannot wake up, even if you're upset, and go to war against Moshe Rabbeinu. Everyone knows who Moshe is. It's in his merit, and he's the one that led them out of Mitzrayim. In his merit, the man falls. He's their leader. He does things for them every day. What type of a following are you going to get, even if you're upset? And so it lies latent and ferments. But then the opportunity presented itself. How so? In the one case that in the estimation of the people, Moshe failed to deliver. And that is the episode of the Meraglim. After all, the Meraglim is very different than anything that had happened before. With all prior offenses, shall we say, there was trouble and some measure of retribution, but as far as the Jewish people on the whole were concerned, Moshe Rabbeinu, he saw them through. Even the Egel, and then Hashem said, he's going to destroy the Jewish people, Moshe intercedes, and they're saved. The other episodes, there's trouble, Moshe sees it through. And what happens with the Meraglim? Moshe does not make everything okay. When Hashem says they're all going to die out in the Midbar, and that's what happens. And it cannot be reversed. And therefore, finally, there's an atmosphere of a certain level of disappointment, disillusionment with Moshe Rabbeinu. He's Moshe Rabbeinu. He can do anything. How come he couldn't reverse this decree, this simple decree that we should all die in the Midbar? He did it with the Egel, he did it with the other. How come he didn't do it here? What went wrong? Or what didn't he do for us this time? And therefore, in such an atmosphere, latent things were able to resurface. And Korah says, yes, it's true. And what about the Avodah? And that's called Litfos Tramp. To capitalize on the situation in order to bring up other issues that have lain dormant. So what's the irony? The irony is that the great rebellion, so to speak, this terrible episode against Moshe Rabbeinu, it was born of an exaggerated or unrealistic sense of what it was that Moshe could do for them. Moshe can do many things, and Moshe can do almost anything, but he can't do everything. But amazingly, the Jewish people said, well, yes, he can, because he's Moshe. And therefore, their unrealistic expectation that there was no situation that they could make wrong, that Moshe couldn't make right again, that they were then disappointed when he didn't do that. So their unrealistically high regard for Moshe led to what became a machlokas against Moshe. That's really, that's the way that it goes. That's the swing of the pendulum. And it's interesting to, and that kan the Ramban. But it's interesting, just in apropos of this, to mention a PS from one of the Talmidei Chachamim of our time, Rav Aaron David Goldberg, Shalita, who was one of the Rosh Hashivas there in Tells, in Ohio, in the Sefer Shiras David, which is a very wonderful Sefer. And he brings us back to the switch of the Avoda. Originally, the Avoda was with Bechorim. And then the Egel happened, and then it moved to the Levim. And the Bechorim are upset. They want it back. And so now the question is, well, who says that you can get it back? As if to say, something's happened. The Egel happened. Things changed. Why are you so insistent or so expectant that things can just revert to the way they were before? It's not realistic. Says the Shir Has David, the claim that they should be able to get the Avodah back is now aligning and intersecting with the general disappointment that people have as a result of the Meraglim. Because it's feeding on that notion, on that slogan, that Moshe can do anything, so why can't he do this? Or why won't he do this? Meaning, whereas the nation in general is saying, why didn't Moshe reverse the decree that we would all die out in the Midbar? That's the point that the Bechorim came and says, and maybe there's other things he could have reversed. He reversed almost everything that happened at the time of the Egel, but why didn't he get the Avodah back to the Bechorim? And therefore, once again, you have this idea that there's nothing that Moshe can't do. How come he didn't do this for us? There was a failure to recognize that there's some things that even Moshe can't do. And even though he's Moshe Rabbeinu, because some things are irreversible. And this really is what Moshe is saying. As in his response, he says, Rav Lachem b'nei Levi, Rav Lachem, you're asking too much. You don't realize that there's certain things that can, there isn't an unending amount of damage that you can do that I can reverse. It's too much. Rav Lachem. He does add that this perhaps will give us further insight into an interesting medrash with regards to Moshe's plea to enter Eretz Yisrael in Parshas Vayeschanan. Vayeschanan al Hashem, he's davening repeatedly, he's begging. Chazal say he davened 515 tefillos, which is a lot. And the answer was no. And Hashem's words to Moshe quotes, Vayom Hashem Eli, Rav Lach. It's too much. Al Tosef, don't talk about it anymore. It's not going to happen. And it didn't happen. But the response was, Rav Lach. And the Medrash comments. And the Medrash says, Berav Biser, Berav Bisruhu. Moshe responded with Rav, and therefore he was responded to with Rav. The Medrash is drawing an equation or a link between Moshe's Rav when he said to Korach's men, Rav Lachem, and Hashem's words to Moshe, Rav Lach. But what's the connection between them? And the Shir Has David suggests that Hashem is reminding, and it's a very wistful moment here. Hashem is reminding Moshe that it's just like you said to Adas Korach, there's certain things that you can't do. You couldn't fix everything for them, and in this instance, you can't fix everything for yourself. And therefore, that Rav Lach, it's a reverberation of that idea, and that's what the Medrash is seeking to communicate. So these are some words with regards to the timing of Korach, and what are some of the arguments? There is two famous questions. Actually, there were more than two, but two of them gained fame, that Korach asked. And seemingly, the goal is to ridicule or to poke fun at Moshe. And what do they ask? Rashi quotes, it's from the Gemara. Korach's famous questions. What about tzitzis? If you have a garment, beged shekula tcheles, a garment that's entirely made of the tcheles thread, which will cost a fortune, by the way, but okay, made of the tcheles thread, does it need a tcheles in the corner? And Moshe says, yes, because that's the halacha. But now Korach gets going. The Talmudic reasoning. Korach says, well, isn't it a kal vachomer? After all, if there's no tchelis in the garment, so one thread will exempt the whole thing, will cover the whole thing. So if the entire garment is made of tchelis, then certainly it shouldn't. Isn't it reasonable it shouldn't need tchelis? But you say that it does? Okay, well, that doesn't seem to be very reasonable. Interestingly, the remez, at least for this question, is in the beginning of the Parsha, which starts, Vayikach Korach. How so? Because those who have an eye on grammar will note that Vayikach Korach is a verb and a subject without an object. The Pasuk never says what Korach took. It just says that he took. And it just keeps on going. And there's so many names that by the time the Pasuk is finished, we've forgotten that the Pasuk never said what it is that he took. But what did he take? And that's why all Mefarshim are talking about this. Perhaps he took himself. That's what Rashi says. He took himself to one side. Perhaps he took all the members of his group and put them together as a group. There's many Perushim. But an interesting rule of grammar is that whenever you have a verb or such like which is unqualified, if there's an object missing, go back to the most recently mentioned object. Well, let's try that. Vayikakorach starts, vayikakorach. What does it take? It doesn't say. Well, what's the most recently mentioned object? Tzitzis. Because the end of Shelach is the parsha of Tzitzis. And therefore, it runs in together, Vasula and Tzitzis. It says, vayikakorach, and that's what Korach took. And that was the beginning of his question to Moshe. His second question, similar in form, it relates to a room which is full of Sifrei Torah. The room is full of Sifrei Torah, says Korach. What do you think, to Moshe Rabbeinu? Needs a mezuzah or no? Says Moshe, needs a mezuzah. Korach gets with the same reasoning. If a room that's empty or a room that's full of other things, two paragraphs can cover the room. So if the entire room is full of Sifrei Torah, so then it shouldn't need a mezuzah. And dot, dot, dot. And that was Korach's attack, his logical attack on Moshe. Of course, not all mitzvahs are subject to human reasoning, which is something that was lost on Korach. But Rabbeinu Bachya discusses further. These are not just questions where the halacha seems to run counter to human reasoning. There's many examples of that, and they're not from human reasoning. But there's more to what Korach is asking. Because tzitzis and mezuzah are really items that they take care of something. They deal with something. You have a whole garment, you put a thread of tchelis at the end, you've taken care of the garment. You have a room, you put a mezuzah, you've taken care of the room. What is Korach saying? Sometimes things don't need to be taken care of because they can take care of themselves. They are self-sufficient, or they are sufficiently significant or of a level that they don't need something from the outside to be overseeing them and taking care of them. Really, what Korach is saying is that you are like the thread of tzitzis, and you are like the mezuzah, but we are like a garment that's all tchelis, and we're okay. And we don't need a thread of tchelis. And we're like a room full of Sifrei Torah. So we don't need a mezuzah. Which means that the halachic questions, not only were they poking fun at the halacha, which was is itself enough, but they were also really targeted against Moshe. I mean, that's really that's the subtext of these questions. In fact, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, the author of the Sefer Maasei Hashem, says, this is why Moshe reacted in a way that was so despairing that he never really had before. It wasn't, as we said before, it wasn't just cumulative. It wasn't just, you know, one, two, three we can deal with, but four is too much. There was something different. There was something insidious about the nature of what was happening here that had never existed before. Beforehand, they took a wrong turn. They made an eagle. It was a terrible thing, but it was an aveira. And so it is with Misonanim, and so it is with Meraklim. Here, something happened that was almost beyond forgiveness, or beyond rectification. And that is, words of Torah themselves were being enlisted for an agenda, for a political agenda, essentially. And what's meant to take the form, and one can only imagine these people making Birchas HaTorah loud and clear before they launch these questions, but to take words of Torah and to drag them through the mud of the Machlokas in order to prove a political point, for Moshe, that was worse than anything that had been encountered before. And that was the momentary Vayipol Apanav until he then gathered a response. So these are some insights into the questions that were asked. But beyond the questions, there was a mood. And it's important also to take note of the mood. The mood, aside from coming from a place of discontent, but there was a mood of leitzonos. There was a mood of mockery. And we find this, for example, that Korach, he paraded these men. He actually had garments of tcheles made. That's what the Gemara says. Hilbisham kulam. Someone was very busy. That could take a year itself, preparing these garments of tchelis, because in order to for visual effect, in order to really bring out the point, it's not enough just to talk about a garment of cheles. He had them wear them as 250 men. That's quite a spectacle. But what's the result? The result is a kind of a feeling of mockery of the whole thing. And there were reverberations. It's very interesting if we just for a moment, so to speak, fast forward to the end of this episode, where the final round was what happened with the staffs, that they staves, that they each tribe, it would put it in the Mishkan, and then Aaron also did, but then it blossomed, and that pretty much sealed in everyone's understanding, and you see everyone just took their staff and went home and QED. It was understood and soundly demonstrated that Shevet Levi was the tribe that was chosen, and within them, Aaron. It's that simple. That test with those sticks, it's apparently all you need. There were no further murmurings after that. Which means there's room for a simple question. And that is, how come that wasn't the first thing that Moshe said? If that's the most effective way of demonstrating the authenticity and veracity of what it is that Moshe is saying, so do that first. So many other things happen with very drastic consequences. And those 250 men, and they were burnt, and Dathan Aviram was swallowed up, and Korach, who knows what happened to him, probably both. And why not just go straight for the six? It's an interesting shaila. And this question is raised by the mashgiach of the Chevron Yeshiva, Zatzal Reb Leib Chassman, in the Sefer Or Yahel. And he explains. The Reb Moshe Chaim Lutzato, in his classic Musar Sefer, Mesilas Yesharim, talks about the trait of Leitzonus, and he talks about it for a while. And essentially, says the Ramchal, one needs to know, as long as a person is possessed of this spirit of mockery, there is basically nothing you can say to them. There is no meaningful dialogue you can have with them. There is no moral discourse that can be conducted with them. Because it just goes by them. He gives an interesting moshel, which is, and here the moshel really fits, as we'll see. He says there were people, before they would go to war, so they'd have their sword, they'd have their shield. What's the shield for? To defend them. But they wouldn't just take a shield. They'd dip it in oil. They'd immerse it in oil. Because there, if there's any arrows, not only will it not reach them, it will just glance off. It will just slide down. It won't even hurt the shield. Says the Ramchal, that's what Leitzonus is like. To talk to a person who's of that mindset, what can you say? Words of rebuke, words of chastisement, words of ethics. It's nothing. It falls to the floor. And goes so far as to say, it's like talking to a person who's inebriated. What are you going to say? They may be an otherwise intelligent person, but not at the moment, not in this state. And that's why the pasuk states, "Nachonu laleitzim shvatim." Sometimes the only response to a leitz, unfortunately, in order to change direction, is not words, but actual some type of calamitous experience. How does that say anything that words wouldn't say? No, but it says it in a way that shakes them out of that state of being. And sometimes people are quite insistent in staying there. It can take a good deal to shake them out. And Rav Chassman says that it's possible to understand, at least as part of what was happening in this episode, that the climate, that Korach, almost like the carnival atmosphere and the snide scoffing that was going on, meant there's nothing that Moshe can say in words. And moreover, if they had the test with the sticks, and even if Aaron's would have blossomed, the result would have been nothing other than another joke coming from Korach's corner, backed by Dathan and Aviram, and then by extension, these 250 men. There's nothing to talk about. Or more correctly, there's no one to talk to. And it's for that reason you see that the first response was such a calamitous one. And those 250 men were burnt, and then Dathan and Abiram, they got swallowed up, etc. and so forth. Once that happened, everything changed. The mood changed. And once the mood changed, the people were almost like back to normal, one could say. It was as simple as just putting the sticks in the Mishkan, come back tomorrow, you'll see who's who, and you'll see what's what. And it's very striking, actually, because that whole parsha with the sticks, the way that it concludes, there's room to say, after all the drama, shall we say, that happens so far, it's a very anticlimactic type of ending. Because this is in Perek Yud Zayin, and they put them in the Mishkan, and Pasuk Kaf Dalet of Perek Yud Zayin. Vayetse Moshe es kol ha-matos min lefnei Hashem. Moshe takes the matos before Hashem, El Kol B'nei Yisrael, and brings them out and presents them to the Jewish people. And then, Vayir'u Vayikru Ish Matehu. Each person saw, and they took their staff, and that's that. In other words, at this final moment, when one may have thought that this is time for a big speech or some type of reaction, there's nothing. Its irons has blossomed. That's it. It's clear. What else should you do now? Just take your stick and go home. It's that simple. But it wasn't simple to get it to that stage where it was that simple, even though it has been all along. Because in order for people to be able to appreciate that simple demonstration, so many other things had to happen. But once they shook themselves out of the, or been shaken out of that whole Leitzanus mindset, nothing could be simpler than just seeing the sticks. And then they took them and went home, and the matter was resolved and never resurfaced. So that's quite an important lesson, not only Machlokas is the general discussion here, but of Leitzanus, to see the power of Leitzanus and how it almost renders everything else powerless, and why some drastic measures are sometimes needed for a situation like that. Well, we've spoken about Korach, we've spoken about the 250 men. What about Dathan and Abiram? It's for the final few moments. What's their role? It's such a disparate assembly of different people here. The 250 men, who were, to a large degree, L'shem Shammai, burnt by holy fire, which pretty much says it all. And then you have Dathan and Abiram, and Korach also, not to forget Korach. So what's the role of Dathan and Abiram? And here we have what seem to be two hashkafas, shall we say, two outlooks, one of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh and one of Rashi. As far as the Or HaChaim HaKadosh is concerned, Dathan and Abiram, they are the prime movers of the Machlokas. Machlokas is their trade. They've been in it for a long while now. And they're the ones that ignite it. They're the force behind it. It is true that the Pasuk says, Vayikach Korach. Yes, because Dathan and Abiram have no credibility. They have a great deal of zeal for Machlokas, but they can't get a following. Who in their right mind would follow them? But a lot of people will follow Korach. And therefore, all they needed to do was to chap Korach, and then they got his following. They got people that would follow him. But they're the ones. And interestingly, there's a very telling pasuk in Parshas Pinchas. It's interesting because it's after the whole story, and it's almost like agav, apropos of the counting, but we have a reference to Dathan and Abiram, which is in Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Tes. Parshas Pinchas, Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Tes. Uvene Eliyav, Nimuel, V'Dathan V'Abiram. Nimuel is a very silent third brother there. Dathan V'Abiram. Who Dathan V'Abiram? This is the very same Dathan V'Abiram, as the Chumash, bringing the episode back. Kuriya Ha'eda, notables. Asher Hitzu al Moshe al Aharon ba'adas Korach, who ignited a machlokas against Moshe and Aaron, together with Adas Korach, Ba'at Sosam al Hashem, when they ignited a machlokas against Hashem. Says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, the way to understand this pasuk is that it's a train, in the sense that you have Dathan and Abiram, and you have Adas Korach, they're not having a machlokus. It's not the same machlokus. Who is Dasan and Aviram's machlokus with? Pasuk says, Asher Hitzu al Moshe va'al Aharon. Their machlokus is with Moshe and Aaron. Together with Adas Korach. Who's Adas Korach's machlokus? The Pasuk concludes, Batzosam al Hashem. They have a grievance against Hashem. I mean, that it's a religious grievance. They feel that they were excluded from the Avoda. They're upset about that. I don't know if it's a machlokus l'shem shamayim, but it's a machlokus against shamayim. But Dasan and Aviram have no such even machlokus. Their machlokus, it's right in front of them. It's with Moshe and Aaron. And there the pasuk lays it out. Dasan and Aviram, hitzu al Moshe val Aaron, adas korach hatzosa mal Hashem. And thus you find, says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, in our parsha, back in Korach, what Moshe does in order to maybe try and quell the machlokus, I mean, who's he talk to? He calls for Dasan and Aviram. That's towards the end of Rishon, right? Vayikra l'Dasan v'Aviram. Why does he call to them? Because they're the instigators. If they back down, the whole thing will dissolve. They're the ones to talk to. In the event, they weren't interested in talking to anyone until they got their own talking to. But they were the ones that Moshe called. That is the Orach Chaim HaKadosh's understanding. It all starts with Dasan and Aviram. They're trouble from the beginning, and they were the beginning of trouble here. Rashi, however, makes an amazing statement. Again, on the first pasuk, which is Vayikra Korach, and then Dasan and Aviram, says Rashi, you know, they were neighbors, Korach and Dasan and Aviram. They're all on the south side, within the Levim, Korach's on the south, within the Machane Yisrael, Reuben's on the south. Says Rashi, you know what this is? It's the old saying, Oy le Rasha, Oy le Shcheinu. Woe to the Rasha, woe to his neighbor. Now, I think that quote from Rashi is quite well known. But what's very important to realize is who is Rashi identifying as the Rasha, and who's the hapless neighbor? Rashi's saying, Dasan and Aviram, you know what happened to them? Bad company. They had bad neighbors. Their neighbors with Korach knew, what do you expect? Now, obviously, there's a lot more to say, because Korach had many neighbors, and not all of them did what Dasan and Aviram did. So clearly, there was a good deal. But that's a big chiddush, to say that Dasan and Aviram, they fell into bad company. Why? As far as we're concerned, Dasan and Aviram, they are the bad company. They are the original bad company. But no. Rashi says that it's really Korach, perhaps as the a linear reading of the pasuk indicates, Korach gets everyone going, including Dasan and Aviram. It's an amazing look at Nadav and Aviram. They were affected by Korach. They were ignited by Korach. Once they were ignited, I mean, they burnt long and loud. But they reacted to Korach. Now, what's fascinating is there are times when episodes in the Chumash are discussed later on, in Tanakh. And the episode of Korach actually is discussed in Tehillim. There are a number of prokem of Tehillim which sweep through quite a bit of Jewish history. One of those prokem is Perek Kuf Vav. And in Perek Kuf Vav Pasuk Tet Zayin, it says, more correctly, Yud Zayin. So here it's talking about the Parsha of Korach. It goes through many, many things in a Tehillim sort of way. Tiftach Eretz Vativ LaDasan. The earth opened. Swallowed up Dasan, Vatechasa Adas Aviram, and covered over the assembly of Aviram. That's it. What's very noteworthy about this pasuk? It's talking about what we would call the episode with Korach, and mentions Dasan and Aviram, and not Korach. Now, how do we account for that? How could you talk about this parsha and mention only Dasan and Aviram? Well, according to the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, perhaps we can understand, because he is telling us that it really was about Dasan and Aviram, primarily. And therefore, as Tehillim puts it, looking back almost thermally, picking out those that are the prime antagonists, it's Dasan and Aviram. They're the only ones to get a mention. What is more difficult is to understand, in Rashi's view, why only Dathan and Aviram mentioned. Because according to Rashi, Dathan and Aviram were put upon by Korach. And they were swept in by Korach. But Korach is the prime antagonist. So if that's the case, why is he missing from this pasuk in Tehillim? It's a good shaila on Rashi. Amazingly, the answer is provided by Rashi on that pasuk in Tehillim. And it's an amazing thing that Rashi says. Tiftach Eretz, says Rashi, Nira, it appears to me, Shechalak Kavod Levnei Korach, that this pasuk in Tehillim is giving honor to the sons of Korach, Milazkir Avim. It doesn't mention their father. Rather, Tala HaKalkala B'Dasan Ba'Aviram. Rather, it puts the whole thing on Dasan and Aviram. What's the background here? As we know, the pasuk itself says, in Pinchas, Uvnei Korach Lo Mesu, Korach's sons, they backed out in time. And they parted ways with their father's approach. Not an easy thing to do. And they broke with the machlokas. Not an easy thing to do. And they did tshuva. Interestingly, they went on to compose songs, some of which are in Tehillim. Lam Natzeach Livnei Korach. They are a special group, really, what we could call Bali tshuva. I mean, they did tshuva. They're original Bali tshuva. And what does the halacha state? You don't remind a Baal Tshuva about their ignoble past. And therefore, says Rashi, if you ask me, and all things being equal, who is the prime antagonist? No question, it's Korach. But if you want to record for posterity, remember the incident. But who are you going to pin it on? Not Korach. You know why? Korach's sons are here. Have respect. They have appreciation. They did Tshuva. And therefore, Korach gets wiped from the retelling. And in fact, I believe this is not only something that happens as late as in Tehillim, I think it happens later in the Chumash. In Parshas Ekev, I don't have the pasuk in front of me, but it's in there in Perek Yud Aleph, when Moshe goes through a list of things that happened, Asher asa this, Asher asa this, and then within the course of that, something like, Asher asa ledasan v'aviram. Remember what Hashem did to Dasan and Aviram. Oh, thank you. So Dasan and Aviram. And here, already at this point, we may ask, no Korach? No, this is the second generation. The only people that are left here are the sons of Korach. Already here you see that Korach has been expunged from the story. We know that Korach was involved, but the way you say it in a pasuk, it makes a difference. And out of deference to Bnei Korach, Korach is missing. It's a fascinating explanation from Rashi himself. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Plenty to think about and to contemplate in terms of Yonah D'Yoma for every day.